Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming out on this stormy morning. Today I'd like to tell you about a person who is very important in my life, even though I only met her twice. Most of you, I'm sure, have heard of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who founded San Francisco Zen Center and who is our Zen teacher's teacher's teacher. But you may not have heard much about his wife. Her name was Mitsu Suzuki, and she died last Saturday. Not yesterday, the week before, at the age of 101. Her picture is on the altar. She's probably in her 60s in that picture. There's another picture here of her when she's 100, or almost. She's probably 99 in this picture. I'm going to post this on the bulletin board afterwards. She was, as I say, she became a very important person to me, even though I only met her twice. But she was a very, very important person to many people who practiced at San Francisco Zen Center through the 60s, 70s, and 80s when she lived there. She's been called the matriarch of Zen in America. She wasn't a Zen teacher, she was a teacher of tea ceremony, but she was very much a Zen teacher in her own way. So I want to tell you about her today. I met her in 2010 on a trip that our teacher, Norman Fisher, asked Michael and me to organize for him and 20 of his senior students to Japan for about 3 weeks. It was quite an adventure. And we stayed for about 5 days at Rinsoin, which is the temple that Suzuki Roshi left to come to teach in the States. And his son, Hoitsu Roshi, is the abbot there now, and his grandson, Shungo, really runs the temple on an everyday basis. The family lives there. Shungo and his wife with their two children, and Hoitsu Roshi and his wife live there in the family quarters. And there's a beautiful old zendo, which seats about 25 people. It's no longer an active monastery, although it once was a small monastery. There are no monks training there. But we set up a kind of makeshift sesshin for our 5 days there. We sat in the zendo and we cooked in the temple kitchen. But we were flexible because anything could happen. People could come for a memorial service or the central zendo space might be needed because it's a pretty active parish temple. So we became part of the flow of temple life there. It was quite wonderful. And there were a number of people on that trip who had been tea ceremony students of Suzuki Sensei, or as she was called there, Oksan. Now, Oksan is how you politely address someone else's wife. It's translated in here as honorable wife, but Oku, actually, the character Oku means inside, the interior. So the wife is referred to as the interior person, you know, the one in the house. who takes care of the interior. It's an interesting word. And san is the all-purpose Mr., Mrs., and Ms. Of Japanese. So honorable seems a little not quite the right translation to me. If you make it san into sama, then it's extra polite, and maybe that would be honorable. So it's sort of like saying Mrs. Interior when you say oksan. But it means, you know, the wife. And that's how she was known to everybody at Zen Center, was oksan. That's what they'd call her, oksan. So one of the people who had known her in the early days called her. She no longer lived at the temple. She lived with her daughter, maybe 20 minutes away. One of the members called up and to give her our regards and have a chat with her, and she decided to come and visit. But she said she didn't want to see the whole big group. She only wanted to see the people who had known her before. So she met for tea with about 8 of us, and Michael and I were fortunate enough to be included in that group because we'd organized the trip and because we spoke Japanese, and people weren't sure how much English she would still speak at that point. But she came in and immediately did 3 bows at the altar and sat down for tea with us, and her English was remarkably good, we thought. And she began to chat. She shared with us a haiku that she had written and that recently won a prize. She was still submitting haiku. She said, "I'm only submitting to one journal now. I was going to stop all of them." Haiku poets submit to different journals and get published and win little prizes. And she said, I was going to stop submitting to all of them, but my son said that would just be too sad, so I'm continuing to submit to the one which was the Soto Zen journal. And this was the haiku she read us, which had just won a prize. And I'm going to read it in Japanese first so you hear the sound of haiku, or the rhythm of haiku in Japanese. Yasasha ni kagiri no nashi ya fuyu sumire. Pretty short. No limit to kindness, winter violets. That's the one she read us. And she read us a couple of others too. And then at some point, she realized that we spoke Japanese, and she shifted to Japanese. And then she just poured forth stories of Suzuki Roshi. It was absolutely delightful. So that I was translating as she went. So it was a wonderful meeting. And one thing we asked her was, how do you stay so bright and healthy in body and mind at the age of then 96? And she said, "I go for a long walk every day, and I make a special point of greeting people who are lonely or who live alone." And she lived near a school for children who can't attend ordinary school. So obviously had special needs of some kind. And she also lived near a kind of dormitory for men, I think, men traveling on business so they could stay for short times. And she would always stop and greet people at the school and at the dormitory, or anyone else she knew who lived alone. The other two things that she said on another occasion about long life, when asked, not by us, but someone else, it was the long walks, not hating people, and having good conversation. Those were her 3 secrets to long life. So I was so moved by her, just by her presence and her clarity and warmth, that I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a translation of her haiku for her 100th birthday? There had been a previous one that Kaz Ta-Nehisi and someone else did for her 70th birthday. And those were her haiku from her time living at San Francisco Zen Center. But her haiku from her time since going back to Japan talk about aging and her life there in Japan, and they're quite lovely. So when I came back, I got in touch with Kaz Ta-Nehisi, who's a wonderful artist and translator and Dogen scholar, who had translated her previous book, and I said, well, what about having another book for her 100th anniversary? And he really liked the idea. And so when he went to Japan next, he met with her and asked if we could do this and if she could give him some haiku manuscripts, and he would make the short list. So he shortlisted 140 for me to then translate. And then he edited what became this book, which came out just in time for her 100th birthday celebration. Also, he solicited memories of her from San Francisco Zen Center people. So the second part of the book is stories and memories of her from people who knew her in the early days. So we were really pleased with how that turned out. And our teacher, Norman, very graciously consented to write an introduction. He's almost getting to be like the Dalai Lama, writing introductions for everything. He gets lots of requests, so we were happy that he would write an introduction. And so, because he did such a good job of it, I would like to read you his account of her life. It's not too long. He says, "The long life of Mitsu Suzuki is an unrepeatable marvel, spanning the changes and disasters of one of the most spectacular centuries in history, one in which East and West have been struggling to meet and understand one another. The winds of time have blown her back and forth across the ocean. Beneath her sweetness, one senses the stoic toughness she possesses, not so much because she was raised to it, but because it was required of her. She was born in Shizuoka City, April 23rd, 1914, at the height of Japanese militarism and competition with the West. Her mother died when she was 11, leaving Mitsu the woman of the household. At 19, dissatisfied with the conventionality and coldness she found in Japanese Buddhism, she converted to Christianity, becoming a member of the local Methodist church. I should say, I'm going to comment as I go here, Christians in Japan often continue to practice Shinto, ancient folk beliefs, as well as still go to their Buddhist temple. You don't sort of unbecome one thing in order to become something else in Japan. And Buddhism, fortunately, has a kind of expansiveness that allows for that. So more about that in a minute. In 1936, at the age of 22, she married Masaharu Matsuno, a naval pilot. When war broke out in 1937 between China and Japan, Masaharu went off with Mitsu 7 months pregnant. He was killed just 2 weeks after seeing the first photographs of his daughter. And this is the daughter with whom she lived when we visited. When Michael and I took another group of people from this Sangha, let's see, Lee was there, Lucille was there, Karen was there on that trip in 2013. I got to see her again, and I got to show her the haiku manuscript, the translation manuscript. She had been quite ill, but had rallied. For about a month, she was quite ill, but she'd rallied and she was having a good day. So her granddaughter-in-law took me to the house to visit, to her daughter's house. When I went in, we went into a kind of sitting room, and the first thing they did was show me the family altar. It was like as though they introduced me to the ancestors, and she showed me the photo of her first husband and said, you know, he went off to war when she, pointing to her daughter in her 70s, was in my belly. You know, she introduced me, and there was Suzuki Roshi's picture. So we had to look. We looked at the photographs on the altar, the very first thing, and it was really moving to me, of course, to see Suzuki Roshi on her altar and her first husband, not forgotten, in his place, and also to see how they were almost a living presence in the family's life, the ancestors there on the altar. And I thought, my goodness, you know, in our culture, we just leave our ancestors behind and don't bring them into our lives in that way. So, continuing. After the war, Mitsu trained as a school teacher, and when her daughter was 3, began teaching at a local kindergarten. When the Pacific War began, what we know of as World War II, and American pilots began flying their interminable and devastating raids over Japan, Mitsu and the other teachers would take their students into bunkers every day as bombs rained down on the city. On the night of June 16, 1945, just 3 months before Japan surrendered, the entire city of Shizuoka was burned to the ground. We don't realize how much incredible devastation was the result of firebombing in a number of cities in Japan. Mitsu, like almost all Japanese of her generation, had been brought up to believe, and had experienced it as a fact, that Americans wanted to kill her and her countrymen. How strange, marvelous, and probably disturbing, then, that by the early 1960s she would find herself living in the United States, the new wife of a Soto Zen priest stationed in San Francisco, a working Japanese Christian single mother, would not have been able to imagine such a thing in 1940, yet it happened. After the war, the schools of Japan were in terrible shape, most of them closed, their facilities destroyed. Civic leaders everywhere rushed to take care of this problem as fast as they could. In Yaizu, Shunryu Suzuki was keen to reopen the historically important kindergarten attached to Rinsoin. That's the temple where we stayed. He had been told of Mitsu by a mutual friend and was determined to hire her to run the school, though she insisted she would not leave Shizuoka. And that, in any case, how could a Christian woman run a Buddhist school? But Shunyu was extremely persistent. He kept reappearing in Shizuoka again and again to ask Mitsu to simply come visit the school. Finally, she agreed. One visit was enough to convince her to take the job. As for the Christian problem, well, at least you have some religion, he told her. She told us an additional story about how he invited several of the most cultured people he could find in Yaizu, the doctor and another teacher, perhaps, I can't remember, but to impress her, you know, and had her for a meal with the most cultured people of Yaizu, because she confessed that she thought Yaizu was a stinky fishing village, as she put it. It's actually quite a busy port, small port city now, with industry as well as fishing. At any rate, she was convinced. Shun Yu visited the school daily, leading the children in chanting and Buddhist lessons. He and Mitsu became close colleagues and friends, two strong, opinionated, and charismatic people with lively senses of humor. Then tragedy befell the Suzuki family. Shun Yu's wife was killed by a mentally ill priest whom he'd allowed to stay at the temple during one of his absences. This was a priest who actually had served in the military. He probably had PTSD. And they took him in post-war, and he, in a kind of psychotic episode, killed Suzuki Roshi's first wife. This is a story that wasn't well known until recently, relatively recently. He was away from the temple at the time. He was left with three young children. He needed a wife. The Rinsoin community, including his mother-in-law, quickly agreed that Mitsu was the only possible choice. The two were married in the fall of 1958. He was 54, she was 44. Within the year, he had been invited to become abbot of Sokoji Temple in San Francisco, fulfilling his lifelong dream of going to America to teach Zen to Westerners. His short-term appointments to Sokoji kept being renewed, and the longer he remained in America, the more young Western students began to come to practice Zazen, not necessarily what the temple members were interested in. Eventually, Shun Yu turned over Rinsoin to his son, Hoitsu, resigned his post at Sokoji, and threw in his lot entirely with the young Western students, founding San Francisco Zen Center. So the Japanese temple for ethnic Japanese parishioners continued separately. By 1961, Mitsu had come to join him. She remained for 32 years, returning home in 1994, 23 years after Shun Yu's death. During those years, Mitsu Suzuki became, by the account of many American students who practiced tea, and yes, in an informal way, Zen with her, an accomplished spiritual master. She inspired affection and respect and was a second mother to many. In her quiet yet forceful and definite way, she expressed and embodied Zen spirit and continuity with the founder. She continued to live in the small apartment in the temple building where she taught tea, cooked, cleaned, tended altars, and received guests. She was an anchor. As long as Oksan remained, as long as she went on day by day quietly expressing her life in engagement and sympathy with the community, things would be okay. Suzuki Roshi died too soon. Even the most developed students he left behind were young and green, full of idealism and Zen theory and moxie, but not enough maturity. They had not lived through the sorts of challenges that Oksan and her husband had experienced during their years in Japan, and so had no basis for appreciating Zen as the religion it actually is, a powerful consolation and source of strength in times of suffering and instability. Oksan's presence expressed this strength and depth during the long years of Zen Center's rocky coming of age. She held down the fort, shored up the foundations. When that work was done, the maturity of the center established, she went home. So I'm going to read you just a few of her haiku. One of the things that's wonderful about haiku in general, and hers as well, is the way they mark the seasons. You know, the almost the sensory experience of the seasons changing. And in Japan, New Year's is very important. Kind of clearing the slate at the end of the old year and starting fresh. Some of you were maybe here New Year's Eve, where we rang the temple bell 108 times. So here's hers, Valley Temple Bell with the Last Ring, a New Century. And you can hear those bells ringing, you know, in Japan you can hear the temple bells ringing 108 on New Year's Eve at midnight. And then there, at the beginning of the new year, there are certain things that you do that are marked as firsts, and they're called hatsu, like your first dream is your hatsu yume, first dream, and you pay attention, you note it. Even your first bath, your hatsu buro, is you know, cleansing, and so this haiku is about her first calligraphy of the year. Hatsu suzuri, kyō mo shōshin to kaki ni keri. First calligraphy of the year. Today, again, I write beginner's mind. And of course, as I said, she was a teacher of tea ceremony. A young monk performs tea ceremony. Hanging kettle sways slightly. A number of her haiku talk about being alone and aging. No friend to share news of my teacher's death. Spring rain. Doesn't say what teacher, but my guess it was probably a haiku mentor, a haiku teacher. Late autumn fireworks. I suddenly glimpse my own shadow. And a number of them express still her missing Suzuki Roshi. This one you need to know that Shincha. Shincha is green tea from the first new buds of the year. And it has a wonderful sort of essence of green fragrance and taste. I pour Shincha into the white porcelain tea bowl he loved. So we use that for the title, the white tea bowl. In the temple kitchen, aroma of boiled daikon, anniversary of his death. Guests departed, alone in the tea room, first winter rain. This bitter cold, my daughter spares no effort. I bow in gratitude. At last, two persimmons ripen to deep orange, 8-year-old tree. Here's another New Year's first. Rooted in my native place, I bow to Mount Fuji, first view of the new year. She talked about a walk that she would take along a kind of canal from which she could see a very distant view of Mount Fuji. This tree of my life has 96 rings, fresh spring breeze. Birth and death, not holding on to even one thing, autumn brightness. That's the one they chose for her Zen Center obituary on the website, which is here. And one more year-end one. I bow to my ballpoint pen and throw it out, year's end. I'll close with a little bit from the, I wrote an afterword in the book about my visit to her in 2013. When I showed her a draft of the translation, she told me that Suzuki Roshi had left her two gifts before he died. One was the advice to slow down and take life at a more leisurely pace. She'd been known for bustling about Zen Center, taking care of everything. The second gift was his suggestion that she take up writing haiku. She only did that just before he died, started writing haiku. Perhaps he had intuited both her ability and her need to express herself. Looking over the manuscript, she and her daughter reminisced, "Oh, that persimmon tree, it snapped off in a big storm, but now it's sending up new shoots from the root." Sensei remembered, sensei means teacher in Japanese, and so you often refer to your tea teacher or your Aikido teacher or teachers, school teachers, you just say sensei or their surname, Suzuki sensei, is how you address teachers. So sensei remembered the long walks she used to take along the banks of a small river with a view of Mount Fuji in the distance. "Getting old is hard," she said as she moved to a chair from the tatami. But as I said goodbye, her eyes were bright and her hands firmly held mine. "Good girl, I'm proud of you," she said to my surprise in English. Then she switched back to Japanese. "Those were the first English words I learned from Wilkinson sensei," she told me. "He was the Canadian Christian missionary who first taught her English and mentored her in her early years as a Christian." The mind reels to think of all that has happened in this world in the 100 years this one small, dauntless woman has lived, and how her life has been shaped by great forces of change. But the gift of her haiku is simple and ordinary. The Japanese say, ichigo ichie, one meeting, one moment. Thank you, sensei, for meeting us. May our intention equally extend
to every being
and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Be